Yeah, I think, Natalie, I you know, you and I have talked about this before, but I spoke with Dr. Kellert for the last time on November 17th of last year, of 2016, and that was about 10 days before he passed. And he was in the hospital, and during the call, we jumped back and forth talking about his medical treatment and about this Native Americans initiative. And toward the end of the conversation, Steve was reflecting on the results of the research and said, we probed more about what it means to be a human being. And I think that's a really good way to put it. I think we need to recognize that this isn't just about conservation or just isn't about recreation, but it's about human flourishing, if you want to use that term. And Steve said it well. I think when we recognize that, it shines a lot different light. It's a lot different perspective than toiling just in protecting habitats, as important as that is.
Hi, and welcome to the Conservation in HD podcast series. I'm Natalie Sexton, Chief of the Human Dimensions Branch of the Fish and Wildlife Service, and we're here today at the National Conservation Training Center and going to be exploring the Nature of Americans, an initiative to understand and connect Americans to nature. This podcast is part of an effort to put tools and resources into the hands of natural resource practitioners and a collaboration with NCTC. So to better understand and foster Americans' relationship with nature, Dr. Stephen Kellert of Yale University and D.J. Case and Associates conducted an unprecedented study of nearly 12,000 adults, children, and parents across the U.S. in 2015 and 16. And we're fortunate enough today to have Dave Case, president of D.J. Case and Associates, and Dr. Daniel Escher, social scientist with D.J. Case, in the studio. We've got Dave here live, and we've got Daniel on the phone from Seattle, Washington. Thanks, you guys, for being here today.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks, Natalie.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Great. So, we're talking about Nature of Americans, and Dave and I and Kristen Gilbert and Tyler Green of the Fish and Wildlife Service just finished a broadcast on this study earlier today, so encourage you guys to take a look at that if you haven't seen it. And we really wanted to, in this podcast, kind of take a deeper dive into the study, what some of the recommendations were for the conservation community, and really what it means for our agency. So Dave, you've been involved in this study really since the get-go, since its inception. This was a huge comprehensive national study with many partners, the Fish and Wildlife Service being one of them. Can you talk a little bit about the genesis of the study and how it came to be?
Yes, Natalie. In 2011, Dr. Stephen Kellert, who tragically passed away in this past November, and unfortunately is no longer with us, he came to our office. And you know, of course, Steve was one of the early human dimension specialists. His work in the late 1970s was some of the first kind of national scale human dimensions work, and it was funded by the Fish and Wildlife Service. And we got to talking about the concept of biophilia, the work that he'd been doing over his career. And we talked about the idea of trying to take a closer look again at the American public and their relationship to nature through the lens that a lot has changed in society. And we also have a lot better understanding of how people relate to nature. And we were getting a sense, and there are lots of emerging data, that indeed nature and contact with nature was more than just an amenity, that it was a kind of a fundamental part of human health and well-being. So we really wanted to explore a much deeper kind of relationship than had been done in previous research. So we, over the next couple of years, starting in 2011, designed the study that we ultimately are talking about here today.
Great. Yeah, I just, when I first learned about this, I was just so excited that we were a sponsor along with Disney and some key state fish and wildlife agencies, Texas and Florida. And really, I think there's so much talk that's been going on over the last several years about this idea of relevancy and the work of conservation organizations and what is our role and how can we be more strategic and more effective at connecting people with nature. So just really excited that this work is out. So Daniel, as a trained social scientist, you've been really the social science brains behind the scenes, making sense of what you've said, Dave, was not just mountains of data, but a mountain range of data. Can you give us a few details on some of the rigor of the survey, who was surveyed, kind of how you went about it to ensure that it was the best that it could be?
Sure. Yeah, this was certainly a very rigorous study, one of the most rigorous that I've seen done on issues around nature and conservation and the environment. It involved several phases to it. For adults, we started by conducting 15 focus groups in many of the major cities across the U.S. This helped us refine our ideas and questions and research interests. Then we teamed up with a company that specializes in online surveying, and we talked to over 10,000 adults in both English and Spanish. And then by asking them a series of questions about their behaviors, attitudes, and demographics, we ensured that the people we talked to represent the overall U.S. population in those ways. For our research on kids, we had to be especially careful. So we got permission from their parents. We adjusted the questions to be age appropriate, to make sense for the children that we interviewed. And we also asked their parents many of the same questions to corroborate what their children said. Mm-hmm. So when all was said and done, at the end of 2 years of data collection, we had talked to 119 adults in these focus groups, to over 10,000 adults in online surveys, and then to 771 8 to 12-year-olds and 771 parents. One of the most impressive aspects of the study to me was that we were really concerned about including minority voices. So we made sure to oversample Blacks, Hispanics or Latinos, and Asian Americans. Another impressive aspect to me was that we asked a wide range of questions, and we also gave respondents the chance to answer kind of closed or forced choice questions, but then we also gave them an opportunity to answer open-ended questions. And I think, and Dave and you, Natalie, I'm sure certainly agree that this is where some of the richest data came from, mm-hmm. is when we were able to let children talk about their most memorable times in nature, or when we were able to let adults talk about their most influential experience in nature while they were growing up.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for that background. That is really thorough, and I appreciate you giving us some more insights into that. Let's jump into some of the results, or did you want to add some more?
Well, you could talk about the method for a long time. It's really interesting stuff. But the one thing that with the children, we got a sample of children in the five largest states in the country that make up the 771. But we interviewed the children webcam to webcam.
Okay.
We're able to have a personal interview with them and recorded what they said. So it was the children didn't have to fill out a form.
Okay. Were there some funny ones?
Oh, well, and what Daniel said, the qualitative stuff. In other words, we ask open-ended questions. You know, what was your most memorable experience? Mm-hmm. Is there a special place in nature? And then let them answer and mm-hmm. and talk. And we recorded it, mm-hmm. Captured the notes of it. And we have hundreds and hundreds of pages of those answers. And it's just... You know, so when we talk about some of the data, it's backed up by hearing the enthusiasm how quickly children could answer those questions and how in depth, and it's just really fascinating stuff.
Neat. So what were some of the key takeaways? I know that's hard to narrow down, but what were some of the ones that really rise to the top?
Well, Daniel, why don't you start that?
Yeah, one of the findings that emerged again and again throughout the study was the reality that nature for the vast majority of Americans is a social experience. In other words, nature, time in the outdoors, memorable places, memorable experiences, influential moments, these almost always happen when other people are present. And it seems as if they happen because other people are present. In other words, very few people talk about one-off experiences in a new place where they're by themselves as being highly memorable. Instead, they talk about the exact opposite. They talk about places that are familiar to them, where they are repeatedly going there or have gone there, and they're surrounded by people who they enjoy being with.
Wow, that's really different than the way that we provide, that we tend to portray, or maybe some of us in our agency think about nature experiences.
There's no doubt that solitude is an important aspect of nature experiences for some people, but especially for those people who are not participating as much as they'd like, or are not participating at all. The idea of promoting the experience, as you say, as we often do, a lot of us in the conservation community think of the best nature experience as being out there by ourselves, far, far away from people. And if that's how we always portray engaging with nature, then we're going to miss a lot of people who don't have the time, don't have the money, or just don't have the social comfort to be in these foreign places by themselves or with a very small group of people that are so we probably send the wrong message. You have to go far away and you have to be by yourself in a place that looks intimidating if you're not familiar with these areas. And so I think it's a really important insight. One of the things that came out of the research that was real clear is that people value nature in lots of different ways. It's not just about the knowledge that they get from learning about nature, those kinds of things. So much of what we do often focuses on trying to teach people information, like we need to increase their knowledge or their education about nature, with the idea that if they're more educated, then they'll be more inclined to participate or more supportive of conservation efforts. And I think what we, kind of a summary recommendation out of the research is that, yes, that's important, but there are lots of other ways to connect people that through play, through activities that are fun, that don't necessarily, we don't want to measure our effectiveness just by whether people learned more facts. Because when we look at some of the data, in fact, how interested kids were in nature or adults are in nature, it doesn't necessarily relate to how much they know about it. It's probably related to other emotional connections and fun and engaging and other activities, not just knowledge. So I think we have to be careful of always thinking of our education programs or outdoor programs as imparting facts.
Well, and we certainly know that from other social science research, that there's many things that go into influencing conservation behavior, and that awareness and that information is certainly one of them. But we know that rarely in and of itself leads to change in behavior, whether that's what people are doing or how they're feeling about the resources. So that makes a lot of sense.
One other major takeaway or surprising result from the study has to do with children. When we conducted the focus groups, we heard over and over again from parents and from grandparents that they were concerned about the younger generation, that they were concerned about their children, concerned about their use of electronic devices, concerned about their consumption of media. And certainly those are very real concerns. And I think we'll return to those later in the podcast. But what's encouraging to see is that children themselves are highly interested in the natural world. The vast majority of them say that they like being outdoors around nature. The vast majority of them would rather play in woods and on trees than play on neat-looking grass. The vast majority say that wild animals are not ugly, right? So these are indications that there's good potential in the younger generation to have a deep connection, to have a deep engagement with the natural world, although, again, they face obstacles in trying to live out that experience or trying to live out that interest.
Daniel, could you talk a little bit? I think it's what we've all come to know to be true, but can you just touch on a few of those barriers that through this research you were able to affirm are indeed realities that we face with this effort to continue to connect people with nature?
Sure. I think one of the things that's important to keep in mind when we're conducting this type of research is that many of the barriers that people face actually don't exist on an individual level. In other words, they are kind of massive society-wide barriers that aren't just a matter of having the wrong attitude about something or holding the wrong value about something, but they're really things that affect daily life in a number of different ways. One of them, if you take a look out the window where you're currently listening to this podcast, one of them is the very physical environment in which you live. People in our focus groups talk about concrete jungles. They talk about the difficulty of finding uncultivated gardens or woods or forests. Another major reason is that there's competition for time, that the economy means that people have long commutes and some of them work two jobs or even three jobs. Another major thing that gets in the way is technology. It is electronic media. And what's interesting, there's a lot of interesting things about these barriers. One of the aspects that people in our focus groups pointed out is this connection between what happens in technology and what happens in society. And so one woman made the very astute observation that one of the reasons that people are disconnected from nature is because they're so connected to their technology. And so if we can think about these large-scale kinds of issues and begin to think about strategies or programs or ways around them, ways to take them into account, then I think we'll be much more successful at engaging larger swaths of people.
Yeah, well, that certainly does present, and I think affirms what we've been hearing and have seen to be true in terms of some of those societal issues that really stand in the way, even when we have an interest in connecting with nature, let alone if we maybe have been less connected over time. Or we just, being at NCTC this week, was able to hear for a second time Professor Rochelle Winkler talk about a bunch of different demographic trends. And, just that we're in this era where we're not only one generation, but going on two generations disconnected from living in rural areas, and what that means for the way in which we, in which we view nature.
Right. I think one of the ways that adults talked about that in our study was they said that there's a declining direct dependence on the natural world. In other words, we have a number of ways now to get us out of having to directly deal with where our food comes from or what the weather's like outside.
So, yeah, it sounds like that really underscores and kind of confirms a lot that we have heard and have seen that are real barriers to connecting with nature. Dave, what, I know that there are some messages of hope here and some of the data that does give us cause for, ideas about how to bridge some of this. Can you highlight a few of those?
Yeah, I think there's a number of reasons for optimism. I mean, clearly there are lots of barriers. People don't spend nearly as much time outdoors. They're satisfied with that, which is probably not a good thing. But the one that jumped out to me, probably the thing that surprised me the most, was when we asked people about their support for conservation, they supported conservation. But it was fascinating the degree to which people the American public already recognizes the benefits to contact with nature to them individually. When we ask people the question, in your opinion, how important is getting outdoors and into nature for helping your physical health? In your opinion, how important is getting outdoors and into nature for helping your physical health? 3 out of 4 people said it was very or extremely important. And when you ask about emotional health, it was the same thing, the emotional outlook. In your opinion, how important is getting outdoors and into nature for helping your emotional outlook on life? 3 out of 4 said it was very or extremely important. So in the conservation community, we see this as very important, but I think assume that the American public really wasn't tuned into that. And boy, these results and there are a whole bunch of other questions that get at that much deeper meaning to nature that a lot of us experience, but with the assumption that not lots of other people do not experience that. And yet our results show that they do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so probably don't need spend a lot of time telling people the reasons why they need to get outdoors.
Absolutely, yeah. They know the reasons. Yeah. What we need to do is figure out how to help them overcome some of those barriers.
Well, right, and I think, you know, it still can feel really like a heavy lift to bridge that gap, and particularly like for, you know, a single conservation organization, you know, like the Fish and Wildlife Service. So how do we, as a conservation organization, address this gap? And then is that, you know, I've heard some say, is that our job, you know, to do that? Is that our role? Do we need to be addressing these larger societal issues?
I think we do need to be addressing them. If you buy into the notion that we need to conserve our jobs in the conservation community is first to conserve these resources for future generations, but also I think it's part of our job to provide those for people to enjoy. And if we buy into the idea that it's important for human health and well-being, then the degree to which we can help people engage with those resources, it's going to be good for those people. It's going to be good for their families. It's going to be good for the communities, and it's going to be good for the country. And so I think engaging, that is part of what we should do. Now we obviously have other responsibilities in relation to resources, to natural resources, to be working on those and doing things and spending budget and so on those things. But related to that then is if we need additional funding, we need additional help, the country really, but the resource agencies in particular, when people begin to recognize that this has an impact on healthcare, on education, on infrastructure, then all of a sudden we the conservation community, have a seat at the table, mm-hmm, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot more funds being spent on those things than there are directly on conservation. So I think it's important to this research helps us support that idea that these are important to the American public. They think we should be spending money and resources and time on these things, and they believe it contributes to their health and well-being. And there's a whole body of literature that's coming out just in the last few years. Since we sat down with Dr. Keller in 2011, there's been a lot of stuff published about the impact of contact with nature on health and well-being. And it's starting to be incorporated into education curriculum, into infrastructure development, and all those kinds of things. And we should really be pushing so that we're there at the table to help people do that in a way that conserves resources, but also enhances the ability for us to engage with nature.
Yeah, I mean, some doctors are even writing prescriptions, nature prescriptions. So you talked about a seat at the table and really thinking about that table maybe a little bit differently and where we can, where these conversations about nature may be happening in unexpected places. Do either of you have some other insights for the conservation community, land managers, on you know, what this these results indicate that we might be doing or maybe thinking about differently?
Yeah, I'll jump in here. Piggybacking off of what Dave was saying, I think that the data here provide a number of clear implications for how conservationists and land managers can run their programs and more generally engage the American public. So when we hear about massive society-wide barriers, I think that can often be paralyzing, and you can almost hear the creativity getting sucked out of the room. And so instead of thinking about how to overcome barriers, I find it much more productive and useful to think about facilitators. What gets people connected to nature? What gets them out at a park? What gets them fishing for the first time or the 500th time, right? And the research that we conducted provides a number of insights into that. One of them that we've already discussed here is that these experiences, these programs, these strategies should be inherently social. They should encourage groups of people to come together. They should encourage parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles and siblings and cousins and friends to participate together. They should also take advantage of the fact that Americans have multidimensional interest in nature. They don't just want to learn formal facts about nature. They also want to experience nature's beauty. They want to feel peace when they're in the outdoors. They want to use nature for natural resources. And so we can take advantage and think about ways to incorporate all of the different values of people into their nature experiences. And then a third thing I would mention is that we also want to, you know, be aware of and take advantage of differences across, let's say, age. So when we're thinking about a hiking program or a camping program, well, it turns out that younger adults are much more interested in doing that than older adults are. But for something like visiting a zoo or taking a walk outdoors, interest in that is very stable across ages. And so if you're thinking about promoting an intergenerational experience, well, a great way to do that would be to promote a walk outdoors or to promote a fishing experience outdoors, right? It wouldn't be to have a grueling 20-mile hike. So these are some of the ways, I think, that we can begin to think about overcoming or navigating around these barriers.
Yeah, I like the way that you're framing that. You know, we're probably on our own not going to be able to alleviate the barriers, but there are strategies that we can use as workarounds or as to kind of maybe in spite of the barriers or in the event of tech or the issue of technology, you know, use that to our advantage to make some of those connections. Dave, how about from you, other insights?
Yeah, I think we've touched on this a little bit, but I think it bears repeating and building on a little bit. And that is that, you know, when we ask adults and we ask children what nature is, you know, fundamental question, they had really different perceptions in one key way, and that was where it's located. So often, adults tend to think of it as far away, and it kind of relates to this idea that it's an iconic place like Yellowstone or the Grand Canyon, maybe they see once in their lifetime. It's not some place they're going to experience very, very often. And now, adults did in the focus groups and on the surveys, talk more about local things. But children invariably talked about things just literally right out their back door. So the idea that somehow we have to get the children in the car once again for another trip to take them to some faraway place to enjoy nature, for children, that's not the case at all. They're perfectly happy with local parks, the backyard, and other places. It's just and just being able to play in the woods or play in the creek or all those kinds of things. So I think in general, trying not to frame engagement with nature has to occur in some other place, but it's local. And particularly when we're talking about children, it really opens the door for much simpler, more basic things. And we all kind of know that intuitively. But we often try to get carried away with trying to give these experiences that are more adult-like and that would appeal to adults, but really aren't needed for children.
Wow, that really has a lot of implications for the refuge system, where we have a refuge, within miles of nearly every city. And this idea of, you know, I don't know that we've always thought of ourselves as that nearby nature, but I think we're starting to, and I think this research helps to inform that. And it certainly has, implications for local parks and green spaces and the role that they play in that connection with nature.
I'd add one other thing that I think is worth noting is again, a lot of us in the conservation community have this idea that there's this huge difference in attitudes and opinions and interaction regarding nature between people that live in rural areas versus urban or suburban areas. And we were surprised, especially when you start to ask about how important nature is to conserve or how important it is in their life, that people who identified and they self-identified, whether they're urban, suburban, or rural, there just weren't the differences we expected in how, in those big picture kinds of things between urban and rural residents. In other words, a lot of the things we've talked about so far really apply not much differently between urban populations and rural populations. And of course, that once you see that, it starts to fit with the idea that we're pretty much becoming an all-urban society. Even people who live in rural areas are interacting as urban in lots of ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that is definitely interesting, and especially with, so much emphasis, I think, on connecting urban residents with nature and maybe an assumption that is somehow, that the disconnection is only happening in urban areas, but it's really societal. Yeah, that's great. So guys, this has really given us all a lot to think about. It can maybe be a little overwhelming at times. There's lots of societal barriers, but a lot of messages for hope and reasons to be encouraged. So where do we go from here?
So where do we go from here? Well, looking at what the results tell us, what we think is most important is focusing on this interest-action gap. So we know that Americans are highly interested in nature. We know that kids and adults alike recognize nature's benefits for their health, for their emotional well-being. What we need to do now is work in a systematic way using effective, tested methods to overcome that gap, to focus on those facilitators, to focus on what gets people around those massive society-wide barriers that many of them face.
Yeah, I think, Natalie, you and I have talked about this before, but I spoke with Dr. Kellert for the last time on November 17th of last year, of 2016, and that was about 10 days before he passed. And he was in the hospital, and during the call, we jumped back and forth talking about his medical treatment and about this Native Americans initiative. And toward the end of the conversation, Steve was reflecting on the results of the research and said, we probed more about what it means to be a human being. And I think that's a really good way to put it. I think we need to recognize that this isn't just about conservation or just isn't about recreation, but it's about human flourishing, if you want to use that term. And Steve said it well. I think when we recognize that, it shines a lot different light. It's a lot different perspective than toiling just in protecting habitats, as important as that is.
Yeah, and I think, boy, that's really inspiring, maybe a little overwhelming at times, but certainly really, like you said, I think shines an even brighter light on the work that we do and how important it is for, society and for our overall well-being. Yeah. Well, thank you guys so much for taking time today. I could talk about this study just on and on. It's fascinating. I just can't underscore the importance of this work and this type of social science to inform the work that we're doing. There's many, many things that we're doing in the service that this work is informing. And I just finished up a podcast with Kristen Gilbert and Tyler Green today where we touched on a few of those priorities. Really encourage folks listening to go to the natureofamericans.org website. It's very, very well done. It's some really awesome visualizations in easy-to-digest bites of these study results. Of course, you can always read the 300-page report as well. That's very well done. And the website really does a nice job at portraying that. Like I said, there's the broadcast that will be available soon called Nature of Americans, so check that out as well. Really appreciate you guys being with us. We have done several podcasts and we have several more in the works, and they can all be found on the NCTC podcast page, which you can find by Googling NCTC podcasts. And you can also be notified of new podcasts by subscribing to iTunes if you're an iPhone user or have an iPad, and just search Human Dimensions and Conservation in the iTunes store and you will see the podcast episodes. Also, we provide updates when these and other products are available. If you'd like to be on our email list, just email human_dimensions@fws.gov. And if listeners would like to reach out to either one of you, I understand they can do that on the Nature of Americans website.
That's
right?
Best. There's yeah, we're really encouraging people to go there. There's lots of information there, including all the reports you mentioned. And we're going to be providing updates on Nature of Americans as we do additional analyses, as programs are developing, that kind of thing.
Super. Thank you all so much. And until next time, have a great day.